This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Okay, Mitch Petrie, I want to return to something we were talking about before we turned the machine on. Did you say that musky fishing in Minnesota is called the fish of a 10,000 casts?
Yeah, not just
are
Minnesota.
You guys, but is, oh, not just in Minnesota.
Not just Minnesota,
I thought maybe you're
right.
Confusing that with the state.
10,000 lakes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so it's just a number that was stuck in someone's head.
Right. No, they say the fish of 10,000 casts.
I've heard that
That's
as well.
That's just a known thing.
Yeah. But the way we do it, it's not the fish of 10,000 casts. The fish, I would tell you, it's evolved over the last 5 years. The lake we'll fish on has zebra mussels and a lot of milfoil. So the water clarity has really improved.
Mm-hmm.
And the muskies have moved a little deeper. 5 years ago, there's hazards all over the lake. And the fish will, there's always fish at these hazards. Not always the same fish, but the structure is so perfect. We could just go and you would have a musky encounter almost guaranteed.
You don't want to say the name of the lake.
It's not a secret. There's no secrets in, it's Lake Minnetonka.
There's no secrets in musky fishing.
No, which is funny because you'll see guys out there that they'll post photos and they'll delete the backdrop. So people don't know where they are, but it's like, well, you can figure out where they are for the most part. But, no, it's a great musky lake and it's under a fair amount. There's a lot of pressure, but there's a lot of fish. I think the DNR estimates there's 1,000 trophy muskies in Lake Minnetonka.
What makes a trophy muskie?
50 inches.
50 inches.
That's what we're going for tonight, 50-inch muskie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow is right.
Yeah. Now, are there all kinds of northerns mixed in with these muskies?
There are northerns and bass. The lake, it's an amazing lake, and it's 25 minutes from downtown Minneapolis.
Hence the pressure.
Yeah. Yeah.
In your lifetime, how many muskies have you caught?
15. I've only been doing it for...
Have you been counting your casts on a golf clicker?
I haven't.
You need a golf clicker that goes really high.
Yeah, I haven't. But I had a young guy who worked for me, was a musky guru, and he got me into it. My boss at the time, a guy named Ron Shera, who was a local writer, he wrote the Outdoor Beat for the Minneapolis Star Tribune for 40 years. His advice to me when he heard that I was getting into musky fishing was to take all my musky gear and destroy it before it ruins my marriage, because mm-hmm. that's kind of what musky fishing does.
And it sucks in because you can't catch them. You can't,
right, fit, yeah, exactly.
can't master it.
Right.
My maternal grandfather was a very avid musky fisherman.
Yeah.
He would fish northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a great place for it as well. That's epicenter.
He was a live bait musky fisherman, as I think probably most people were back then, right?
Sure. We use live baits here in the fall. So as the season goes on, the muskies start eating bigger baits, and then in the fall we slow troll suckers, live suckers, like 20-inch suckers.
Whoa!
It's pretty cool because
it's like fishing halibut.
Yeah, and you're just sitting, you're watching. You watch the tip of your rod; it will start bobbing, and then you feed it line, and because the muskie, once they get it in their mouth, it's not like a trout or something. If they feel it doesn't feel right, they spit it out right away. That once they taste that meat in their mouth, it's on my bucket list. I haven't done it, but I've seen it on like YouTube. Muskies will take the sucker, and they won't have the hooks in their mouth, but guys will, you'll boat the fish, and they're just holding on to the live sucker. They don't even have a hook in their mouth, but they won't let go of it. So.
Yeah, because they got the, like a northern, they got those back angled. They got
the teeth that lock that.
Yeah, it's kind of meant when they grab something, man, it's like.
It's going to rip when you pull it out.
Right? Yeah, it's not like, that's not a two-way street.
No.
We heard that same thing about the lingcod, right?
Yeah.
A couple weeks
ago. Oh, that's real. Yeah, you hear all, I haven't seen it happen. But anyone that spends a ton of time fishing them talks about catching them that aren't hooked.
Yeah.
And then people are always catching lingcod. Latched onto another lingcod, latched onto a rockfish, latched onto a pink salmon.
Sure.
He just comes up in the boat.
We do a lot of fishing in northern Minnesota and walleye fishing, and a lot of stories of northern pike smacking a walleye as you're bringing it in.
Yeah.
Same deal. They'll hold on to that pretty good too.
I have brought in northerns that were on something else and not hooked. And in fact, not too long ago, my little boy caught a largemouth on a bluegill and got it up in the boat, into a pontoon boat.
Yeah.
And that thing wasn't hooked.
That's fine. Just holding on.
Yeah.
I've had been bass fishing with little plastic worms, and I've had sunfish holding on to the worm, not hooked, come into the boat that way.
Yeah, he's ready for a big fight.
Yeah.
Not here to talk about, not here at all to talk about muskies, but lifelong Minnesotan.
Yes, sir.
Born and raised.
Born and raised. Minnesota's just where my family is. I've lived overseas, but I always came back here. And I told my boss, Minnesota's a hard place to recruit people to come live here, because probably the winters. But it's a hard place to recruit from as well. I think, you know, we have four seasons. Summers are relatively short, but, you know, you get a good spring and a good fall. And, yes, there's over 10,000 lakes, which I thought was a pretty big deal till I went to Saskatchewan, and there's like 100,000 up there. But we have a very, very good, you know, it's a little bit, you know, I do a lot of work in Colorado, and, you know, and out west, great outdoor lifestyle. Minnesota has a little bit of that, just no mountains, but a lot of lakes. A
lot of water.
A lot of water.
Also, real quick, also joined by Ryan Callahan, who's in it. You're just coming from the outdoor retailers
trade show. Yeah, outdoor retailer, yeah. Also in Denver. Pretty good time.
Fish out of water or no?
No, not at all.
There's not a super hunting crowd over there.
You know, oddly enough, so I went, I was invited to kind of talk about hunting on a public panel at the winter session with folks from REI, Patagonia, you know, on this big public forum, and it was kind of intimidating, but after we got done with that panel, I can't tell you how many people came up and they're like, man, that was great. And, you know, just so you know, I'm a hunter too. And then, and
like,
I
psst, buddy.
Yeah, it was. Yes, it was. And then, and I really like this trade show because it's not hunting specific. I can just kind of lurk around and actually check things out you know, the hunting community is so small, you're always running into people you know constantly. You can't ever get anything done. So, but
you could just enjoy your anonymity.
Yep.
And look at product.
Yeah. But this, I got stopped a ton. A lot of Meat Eater fans, lots of folks that listen to the podcast, lots of, seemed like old Dirt Myth was there as well. And we checked out a couple of, you know, different companies for, you know, the stuff that we use all the time, sleeping bags and pads and boots, and every stop somebody in the booth would like break away from the conversation they were having, come over and be like, hey, you thank you guys so much for what you're doing, like, love the show.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it was super cool.
And this is the one that pulled, this is what we're here to talk about either, but just real quick, Outdoor Retailers is the one that in protest of public lands issues out of Utah, like, it's Outdoor Retailers that pulled out and went to Denver, right?
Yes.
It had traditionally been in Salt Lake City.
Yeah, it's been in Salt Lake for a long time. In an effort to sway Governor Herbert at the time on a lot of their beliefs on monuments, specifically the rescinding of Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. They were leveraging with this giant check, this huge revenue stream that would come into Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
And if you've ever been to the Salt Palace in Salt Lake City, you know, most of those hotels and stuff down there didn't exist prior to that show. And so they said, well, we're going to pull out if you guys support this.
And then they actually did it.
And they actually did it, yeah. Huh. Which, you know, there's a real strong argument there that if you want to make some change, you got to stick around, not take your ball and go home, too. So it's not, as per usual, it's not a cut and dry situation.
Yeah.
So
I heard on some feedback, because I was in Denver yesterday as well, that maybe last year or 2 years ago, there was like no camo at Outdoor Retailer, and this year it seemed like I heard every booth, a lot of products. I think OtterBox has had a big presence there this year.
Yeah.
A lot of camouflage at Outdoor Retailer.
Like cool kid snowboarding type camo?
Like squiggly line camo. Like,
It's like part of the snowboarding, kind of came out of the snowboarding scene, or like camo like for like hiding from stuff?
Winter OR, you know, your ski brands. Sure enough, you know, camo is hip.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not stuff that you would see traditionally in the hunting space for the most part. Summer OR, there was definitely like a little bit more, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but these, Outdoor Research, Patagonia, lots of these big brands also do military business.
Yeah.
And you know, that if you're looking, you can see some of that stuff sitting on the displays as well. So
yeah, Arc'teryx, OR, Patagonia, all do military contracting.
Yes. And
that stuff goes to the dudes who are kicking down doors in places, man.
I mean, this isn't stuff that the general army's buying for everybody.
How about did you see any fishing camo? Because I came off of ICAST a few weeks ago, and now there's a lot of fishing camo patterns.
Yeah.
And that has it's a life. You don't need camo. We won't be wearing camo tonight, or at least not fishing camo when we fish. But
I end up wearing a decent amount of camo when I'm fishing, just because I don't like having.
Yeah, you're accidentally cool.
No, but we saw a lot of fishing camo.
Is it like the blue, like lots of light blues and whites?
Some of it looks like water, squiggly lines.
And some looks like
Orbis
sky.
Does some stuff in camo. Sims has some camo stuff.
Yeah, I have an L.L. Bean shirt that has a kind of a cool. Might wear it tonight, actually.
All right.
Yeah.
I just got an email from a dude. I need to read it more carefully, but this guy was kind of saying that he said, "Yeah, I don't wear camo anymore because it's politically too divisive."
Hmm.
I'm thinking, like, I feel like right now that's not the case.
No, there was a lot of cool kid camo, a lot of skinny jean camo, like,
yeah. And also, Janice Poudlis, Giannis. Got an email the other day from a guy who said his wife's name's Janice, but she spells it J-A-N-I-C-E. And I need to write him back and clarify that it's, in fact, Giannis.
Please do that.
I will. All right, Mitch Petrie, tell everyone what you do for a living.
I'm a vice president of programming for the Outdoor Sportsman Group Networks, which are Outdoor Channel, Sportsman's Channel, and the World Fishing Network.
So if you've got a question about what in the world is the world of outdoor TV, this is the man. It's fair to say you know more about it than maybe anyone at this particular moment, let's say.
I wouldn't say I know more than anyone, but I have a pretty unique perspective on what I know based on all the interactions that I have. I was a producer for 10 years before I joined the network.
Like produced a TV show.
Produced TV shows. I did Wardens in Montana. That was my first breakout hits that got me on the radar of the network, at least.
Wardens gets talked about every time I go home because we were always right around the Sun River Game Range. Yeah, there's that episode with the shed antler and the
radio. Yep. They put little radio controllers in the antler so they can track down. We got some pretty cool stories, and we told a lot of them on Warden. So we did that for 6 years in Montana.
What channel was that on? That wasn't on
Sports. Outdoor Channel.
It was on Outdoor.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, it still is. In fact, we've actually moved it from Montana to Michigan. So it's still going strong. I think we've had probably 150 episodes.
Are you involved with it?
Yeah, I'm still.
Are you still?
Officially, I'm still the executive producer. I started it with a former partner, a guy named Steve Puppy, who got me into television back in the day. He was former Hunter Specialties road warrior, so he had a HS truck and would go and do work trade shows and work different retail with different retailers. And
Hunter Specialties, the game calls.
Yeah. And then he did a DVD, which was probably a VHS at the time, So You Want to Be a Bow Hunter, or So You Want to Be a Turkey Hunter. And he was a Minnesota State champion turkey caller. Anyway, he started his own TV show, and my wife and I got involved with that, and that's how I got dabbling into TV.
Coming out of software sales.
Coming out of software sales.
In France.
Lived in France and in Australia. Worked for a manufacturer. My wife will tell you she married a computer geek and who evolved into a redneck. Because, I mean, I've fished my entire life. I did some pheasant hunting and small game hunting as a kid, you know, from like 13 on. But I've just always been a fisherman. But it just kind of went away. We went overseas and we didn't do that very much. We came back and now she's lost me to fishing and hunting. So you
went, when you were producing the show though, you weren't working with the network, you weren't working with Outdoor Channel, Sportsman Channel.
We had a production company called Muddy Boot Productions, and we did.
So you sold the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, that's one of the first things I want to ask to explain when people wonder about like outdoor TV or people call it hunting TV. Can you explain, because there's different ways in which there's different business models by which the networks will engage with shows, where you have shows that networks own. So you have shows that places like Outdoor Channel, Sportsman Channel will own. There's shows that they license. And then there's a thing called time buys. Can you walk people through what a time buy is?
Sure. Yeah. And I've looked for other examples of television networks similar to ours, and that time buy model exists on a smaller scale in some places, but for the most part, hunting television is just unique.
A time buy model would be like an infomercial show or channel,
right? Exactly. You could do that, but like the Golf Channel, you could buy time on the Golf Channel,
okay.
But most of their programming is owned by the Golf Channel. The way television evolved is, the networks create this platform. You know, they negotiate with the carriers to be in, millions of homes. And before my time, they just went out to producers who were starting to film their hunts and just wanted to put them somewhere. So the network would essentially sell them commercial time and sell them a 30-minute block, and they would get 5 minutes of commercials, and that's kind of how that model was born. So it's still probably 80 to 90% of our business are independent producers looking for a place to air their content. So we have
still 80%.
Yeah, yeah.
And at a time it was 100%.
Right, right. So what happened as things evolved, and the networks start to grow, and the affiliates, want different things. The network started investing in its own content so that we could, like Wardens was an original program, original production that we produced for Outdoor Channel. It didn't fit that time buy model where we couldn't go out and get endorsement deals. We didn't have a host. We had game wardens that we were following. So we couldn't fund the production. But I mean, that's the essence of the time buy model is you create a show. We air it on our network. You get commercial inventory. You sell commercials or other things to your sponsors to fund the production and to pay for your airtime.
But a lot of companies, there's a lot of companies who look at doing a time buy as basically as a marketing spend for the company.
Right, right. One of the shows I produced as an independent was Fox Pro Fur Takers. It's a predator hunting show. And so, that's their brand, Fox Pro. They're hunting anyways, so they started filming, and we did real high quality production. And for them, it's a marketing expense. They also brought in some sponsors to help underwrite it. But at the end of the day, they weren't making a profit on their TV show, but it was a perfect platform to get their message out, to a mass audience. And that's what our networks deliver, are a built in audience who is knows what to expect when they turn on the TV and watch Sportsman's Channel.
So when a company, let's say you play, and let's just say, like take a place like Cabela's or Bass Pro or any manufacturers, they'll do the time buy. And then of course their block of time they have, their half hour segment has the show in it. So they're making a national show, but it also has ad units. So there are companies that they'll come in and use some of the ad units to draw the connection to their own brand,
right?
But then they might also go and have ad units that are used by other outside partners of theirs.
Exactly. Bass Pro Shops has productions. They have their own production operation, so they buy time from us for example, for the Bass Pros on Outdoor Channel. So yes, you know, they run Bass Pro and now Cabela's spots in that show, but they'll also run, well, and they'll do, they've got other brands too, so the Nitro Boats, but they might do a Mercury commercial in it, or they may even have, you know, specific, you know, Strike King or something as a sponsor of the show. So even though the retailer owns the show, they have a team that will go out and sell it. And the NRA does the same thing. Like, we have an NRA show, American Rifleman, that the NRA owns and produces. They have their own production operation, but they go out and sell a lot of advertising around that. And then they have a magazine that supports the production as well.
Yeah. And another thing that happens, and this is, I think, where this is what's a little bit more interesting, is the other thing that happens is an individual can go and build a show.
Right.
Because I think there's a lot of people who like are like, how does a person get a hunting show?
Right.
And I think that this probably like the path, I don't want to say it's the path of least resistance financially, because there's a ton of resistance financially. It's a lot of work to put it together. But like, lay out how a person, like an individual, not a big company, how an individual goes and creates a show and finances a show.
Yeah, it's evolved a little bit because the barrier to entry has gotten a little bit higher. But, you know, 10 years ago, it was a guy who loves to hunt, has a buddy who knows how, in air brackets, how to film or how to edit, and they just, you know, they, and everybody thinks they're interesting and entertaining, so they're gonna do their hunting show. And there are a lot of shows that started that way. But the networks started raising the standard of quality, and you have to start buying better equipment and hiring more talented people and evolve. But there's a lot of people that just started with that dream of wanting to hunt. They watched, you know, Bill Jordan on TV and TNT 30 years ago and wanted to be that. Now there's a lot of people that, you know, want to be the next Michael Waddell. And so there's still that dream of just buying a camera and buying a Mac and cutting a show.
Going and getting a bunch of sponsors,
right,
and selling advertisement space. And
but that's, I think that's, when I advise people early on, because, you know, we get a lot of inquiries, and I usually tell them, you know, you have to probably plan to spend upwards of $500,000 to get a show off the ground, to do it right, to have the production values, and to build a brand to the point where advertisers want to be a part of it. And that's probably the biggest mistake the aspiring outdoor TV personalities make, is these brands are not interested in funding your lifestyle. They're interested in moving product. So some of the best in TV have been, and the most successful, I should say, have understood that. You know, guys like Pat Reeve from Driven TV, I mean, he's been doing this for 30 years. He knows at the end of the day, if he's not using product properly and not overselling it, you know,
not to the point where you raise suspicions,
right? Exactly, yeah. And it's a battle that I fight, because I get it. You need to satisfy your sponsors and your advertisers, but you're also, you know, you don't want to oversell. Viewers can smell the sell. You know, I'd rather see them just use a product properly than say, hey, look at this, you know, thingamajig I'm using here, and this is making me, you know, kill more deer or bigger deer or whatever. Viewers get that. They just want to see the success. So we try to minimize the commercial elements in a show, but, you know, that's what's funding that. But like I said, I think the biggest mistake the youth are making is they feel like, oh, there's no brands out there that, you know, their mission is to help somebody else, you know, pay for their hunting. It's, they want to move product. So, and that's what that's a lot of our content inspires people to get out and hunt, and you know, they learn a lot from, you know, on new products and how to use them and use them properly.
So increasingly you guys want to be, I mean, coming from the network perspective, you want to be in a situation where you're saying like, sure, you're buying space from our network, but there's some parameters around this,
right?
Like,
right. I'll
sell it to you on the condition that your product meets a certain threshold of quality.
Right. And that too has evolved because, you know, Outdoor Channel has had very high standards for the better part of a decade, where, and we've been sold out for the most part for the past 15 years, so we can discriminate a little bit about, you know, what kind of content we're willing to take.
Oh, for 15 years, you haven't had to like worry about how you're going to fill that space up.
In fact, in prime time, you know, I don't have a lot of flexibility because I've got a lot of long time shows that have owned those time slots for a long time and have been very successful, for us and for them. That's I say a lot. I'm in the business of creating these mutually beneficial relationships. We have all of these assets and investments in our networks and building our audience so that when Meat Eater comes on, you know it's gonna reach that audience. And then the producer needs to go out and be successful in selling that time to their sponsors to fund it. And if they're not successful, then we're not going to be successful. But yeah, we've been sold out for the better part of a decade.
When we were emailing, you'd mentioned you mentioned the good, the bad, and the ugly of outdoor television. What do you mean by that?
When I took this job, you know, I had a vision and really a goal to leave hunting and fishing, not just hunting and fishing television, but in a better place than when I came into it. But there's a lot of masters, you know, and there's a lot of, you know, people have very specific tastes in what they like. And so, you know, we have some producers who are, loud and great characters, and they tend to draw a good audience, but they also draw detractors. And so I'll have, you know, people, oh, you need to get rid of that show because of that. Or I'm only into, Western archery hunting. I don't care about Midwest deer and guys whispering in the tree. So, So I have to program the network to reach a broad audience, whether it's, you know, we have upland shows and not everybody, you know, and we have archery shows. And so the ugly thing is I get all the viewer feedback, although social media is evolving some of that. Now, most people just go to the show pages and start bashing and that, but,
they're less likely to call you now.
I mean, if someone wants to, we have a feedback form on our website, and so I'll get it. But so if somebody wants to send feedback, they have to go to our website. It's not hard to find. They find the form, they fill it out, and they have to answer a couple questions, and So by the time I get that kind of feedback, I'm dealing with somebody who's passionate about it. And, we respond to viewer feedback, and I'll personally respond. If someone is critical, as long as they're respectful, I'm happy to respond.
What would be an example of a criticism that would come in? You mean those people being dissatisfied with something they saw?
Right. On Outdoor Channel, we're running some syndicated shows. We're running Wicked Tuna right now, which is an awesome show if you haven't followed Wicked Tuna. And we did Deadliest Catch and Duck Dynasty. And Duck Dynasty, a lot of our people, the core audience, hunting audience, they don't like Duck Dynasty. But
that surprised me to hear when someone who's very familiar with that show was explaining that it's not hunters. Hunters weren't watching that show as much.
Right. So the idea, so like I said, we have many masters, and we work with affiliates, you know, Dish, DirecTV, Comcast, all the major carriers. And this hunting market is not expanding the financial side. There's a finite amount of money in this market. It wasn't getting bigger. Hunting, it's debatable. You know, numbers are declining, or participation is declining. So for our company to succeed and for our producers to succeed, we had an initiative to try to expand our audience. We had research that showed that people who maybe don't participate in hunting or fishing, but like outdoor adventure programming, like Deadliest Catch, like Duck Dynasty, we called them, it's a primary attainable audience for us. So that's why we brought in Duck Dynasty. They have this huge brand, whether you like the show or not. The brand recognition for Duck Dynasty back in the day was like 98% of the general public were aware of Duck Dynasty. And we were the first network to syndicate it. And it brought in new audience. We can show. We've done research. We've seen the numbers. So it actually helped us grow our audience and helps us maintain our distribution. But if I'm a whitetail hunter from Iowa, I don't want to watch Duck Dynasty or, you know, fake reality TV or whatever it is. So
you want to learn how to kill big giant bucks.
That's it. And the reality is this, the hunting market is driven by deer, and the fishing market is driven by bass. So
really,
yeah.
My impression of how hunting, my impression of how people watched hunting TV probably isn't correct. But my idea was that people watched it like how people watch the news, where there's people that just have it on and they just watch what's there. But you're saying that people, like the viewers, cherry pick. They're like, I watch that show. I don't watch that show.
One of the biggest, and this wasn't from research, but just from talking to people, most of our viewers, you know, they're hardcore. So if you're watching hunting, it's because you're really like you're into hunting. And I think they judge the shows they watch mostly by if they would want to be in camp with the talent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hunted last year with Roger Raglan, who's been in the business for 30 years. And part of it was because I was like, when I watch Roger Raglan on TV, I want to experience what it's like to be in a camp with Roger Raglan. And that's a lot of the feedback you get in social media as well. So, you know, Michael Waddell is, oh, I wish I could hunt with Kip Campbell from Red Arrow. So you know, and there are guys that don't appeal to certain people. So I think when they watch it, they're like, yeah, it's like almost, I can't hunt now, but I'm going to be watching these guys hunt. And that's how they pick the shows they like.
What are some of the, kind of like the famous talent pool, right?
Yeah.
What are, like, do you got people that you look forward to them calling and then hosts that you really don't look forward to them calling? Kind of like, right? Because you're communicating with all these people.
Is there a chance any of them will hear this?
No.
No. Okay, good. So no. I started as a producer and had my own company. So I've run a small business, and most of our producers are small business owners, and I've walked that path. It's not easy. So I go into, whether I like somebody personally or connect with them as a friend, whatever, I go into almost all of the conversations with a certain amount of respect for what they're doing, growing their business. You know, we have producers who have, you know, 10, 15 employees, and it's, you know, so they're very passionate about hunting and the business. So yes, there are times when my phone rings and I wouldn't say I cringe, but it's like, okay. The biggest problem I have is I can have three things I need to get done in a day, and my day will be hijacked by like 8:15, and Mondays are the worst because something will come up over the weekend, and so I'll get a call, and they're all important calls, so I try to take them all as I can, but it's hard to get through. But we definitely have characters in the lineup, and there's none that I dislike, but definitely have those that are just a hoot. I'm a sucker for, you know, people with passion. So when anyone, you know, and so I had a conversation today with Mark Zona. He's a bass fishing guy. Zona's Awesome Fishing Show, and the guy, he's hardcore. He is intense. He's an amazing.
That's what it's called. Zona's Awesome Fishing Show. I like the guy already.
He's a Chicago guy. He lives in Michigan, but he's just a great character, and he's somewhat polarizing too. To, you know, some people don't like his style because he's, you know, dude. He says dude a lot, but he's authentic, and I'm drawn to that in our talent. I like talent who are the same off camera and on camera.
Yeah.
Cause, you know, at some point it's hard to, I don't want to know. It's like, oh, I'm this on camera guy or the, it's most of our hosts are authentic, you know, and I like that. And, you know, like, so we work with Ted Nugent, and, to explain Ted, and I've worked closely with him, he's in a league of his own. I mean, he's a rock star. He's a hunting TV star. He's
like literally a rock NRA, star.
Yeah. And I mean, Ted has, there's nobody can do what Ted does. I mean, people think they might be able to do it, but to go on to CNN and take on Piers Morgan and win, just be Ted, you can't. I've met Ted and I've met Donald Trump now, and you can't connect with these guys. Like, we can connect. We can connect over fishing. We can connect over food. We can connect over. Ted is just, he's so driven. And that dude works harder than any human being I've ever seen in my entire life. I mean, he still does like 200 concerts a year. And he hunts like 340 days a year. It's like, seriously. I mean, he is just always out doing something. And he's passionate. So we did something as a network that Ted didn't appreciate. And he called me one day and told me that. And for 15 minutes, he told me that. And I was like, man, and he was,
in a very spirited, very quickly spoken, articulate fashion.
Yeah, no, exactly. And it wasn't bad. And he was not disrespectful, but I was like going, man, most people, if you want to hear Ted Nugent go off like this, you have to find it on YouTube. I'm like one-on-one on the phone. I wish I could have recorded it because he's brilliant that way. And, so that, you know, I enjoy working, with Ted but he's one of the most unique talents on our network.
So when you're fitting out like the programming, right? Do you picture like walking into a big sporting goods store where you're like, here's the fishing section. Make sure the fishing's okay.
Yeah.
And then here's my, you know, kind of like warm water. Here's Upland over here. Here's camping. Here's big game hunting. Here's the waterfowl. Yeah. Like, do you try to keep all that in mind and make sure that you're not missing anything, or do you want to realize now and then that you have like a big hole?
I inherited, first of all, you know, this the lineup essentially and the schedule, and I have a peer who I work with, Katie Gladstone, who actually does the scheduling. So she's more analytical on the schedule, and she's looking at ratings. But the business, the time buy business, has really established a lot of that for us, where seasonally there's less demand in TV, hunting TV, in first and second quarter. So fishing kind of built up in first and second quarter. And then the retail cycles, because hunting retail, you know, it's mostly like September, October, November. So that's when the retailers and the advertisers want to be in there. So the market has kind of driven some of that schedule. And then, yes, we will do... we'll focus more at whitetail or big game in prime time in third and fourth quarter. But, you know, weekend mornings have become fishing pretty much year round. Weekend afternoons are very good day parts for us. So we will run waterfowl, upland, some of the non-big game in those time slots. So it has kind of filtered out that way. Much like you do see in a retail store.
Because you're chasing people's interest, or you're chasing... Because you're chasing what people... Let me put this a different way. So you're timing it out because that's where the advertising dollars are for producers. Or are you timing it out because some guy's like, I'm hunting deer in a week. I want to watch about deer now. And I don't want to watch about deer in May.
Right.
Because in May, I want to watch about fishing.
Right. Yes. Our viewership grows. Viewers watch when they're actually participating.
So there's like a real feedback between what a person's experiencing and what they're wishing to watch.
Right. Yeah. Or like if they're mentally preparing for their hunting season, they'll start watching more hunting. And then while they're...
But what about dudes watching wardens? They're not like saying like, I'm going to be getting busted by a warden next week.
No, wardens was a bit of an anomaly. It and you know, we think it was successful because it had such a broad appeal. Like, and the story packages were smaller. You know, they were only like 5-minute segments. Like, you might not be interested in antler hunting on a game range, but that was only 5 minutes. The next one is going to be, you know, some guy shooting an elk decoy. And that was kind of interesting. So
yeah, because it's like an ensemble type show that follows these bunch of different people,
as opposed to trout fishing historically hasn't rated very well. And so if you're a trout fisherman, you got some of that on wardens, and everybody's had their own warden encounters or warden stories. And when we were in Montana, and now we're in Michigan, those are both great states. I mean, Montana's a very unique state in terms of its resources. So we had viewers just wanted to learn about Montana. And the wardens were great characters there too. So it just had broad appeal.
If you were going to go look at all the, let's just say all the hunting content, so remove fishing content, mm-hmm. all the hunting content from Outdoor Channel and Sportsman Channel, what percent of all of that content is driven by the white-tailed deer?
It's probably 60%.
Wow.
Yeah.
You like that, Yanni, huh? It's the first thing you've said.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
60%. I would have thought higher. I would have thought a little higher.
Whitetails and turkeys, though. What's that?
Yeah, what's
75%?
So what's number two next to whitetails?
We do a lot of elk, so a lot of big game, and some of the moose. So Yeah, it's big game. I think
people like to watch a moose show.
Right. Yeah, Jim Shockey will tell you that, you know, his ratings they bump every time he does a big Yukon moose. So, and that's aspirational. We see a lot of that. You know, there's not a lot of people who participate in sheep hunting or goat hunting, but they'll watch it on TV because it's one thing's interesting though. Your show is very different, I think, but a lot of things, like the big international destinations. And I'm not talking Africa. I'm not, but like, you know, hunting in the Himalayas or as Michael Waddell accused Jim Shockey of hunting red bearded devil goats in Djibouti or something like that. It doesn't really drive, you know, viewership because, you know, your average Joe
can't relate,
wants to see deer, or they can relate to a moose or they can relate to an elk, even if they don't participate now.
Cause because it's in their
deer.
Spatial awareness, man. It's right, like a thing right. That one could feasibly go do.
Right. And people will watch, you'll watch some sheep shows or some of the, like the Ibex shows, or cause the destinations are really cool and it's kind of out there, but they're not driven like they are for deer hunting.
Yeah. I like Shockey though, man. He's a good dude.
He's a very, very interesting guy. Really, really, really nice guy. Authentic too. So last year, he came into our booth at the archery trade show just to say hi. And, I had a brief conversation with him. Within 30 seconds, there's somebody standing next to him waiting to tell him a story or meet him or do something. He was there for like 3 hours meeting his fans and talking to people. He didn't do an appearance. It wasn't a scheduled appearance. It wasn't just loving it.
And yeah, people standing there being like, look at this buck my cousin shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There's a downside to that too. I've had conversations. Will Primos is a guy who I have a lot of respect for.
Dude, is, yeah.
And
there's I'm telling you, as just like a communicator and a consistent personality.
Yeah.
And just like a guy that seems like
a good human being.
Will Primos.
Yeah. So I'm going hunting with him this fall. I get, you know,
good for you.
I get some good opportunities and I want to, have those experiences, you know, while I can. So, I don't get to do a lot, but, Will and I, we actually did some business together 5 years ago and, we had talked about going, and this last year I just said, Will, I think now's the time. I've never gone on an elk hunt. I've probably watched 10,000 elk hunts on TV. So I'm excited. And I'm a very passionate like turkey hunter, and you know when I get a turkey, I call a turkey in, and it's gobbling, and I can feel it drumming and strutting. I just get super excited. So when I have an elk coming at me, and the first time I told Will, I might have to wear diapers because I can't imagine how awesome it's going to be. So we're going to New Mexico, and we're going to do an archery elk hunt in September.
You talk about that thing that happens where it's like you want to be with someone to listen, to, even just to put in, and I. Like honestly have a bunch of the CDs, like to put in his stuff and hear Will Primos explain things, right?
Right.
He just explains things now and then in a way where I'm jealous that I hadn't thought to put it that way.
Yeah. And that it's, you're drawn into Will and the Primos, just, it's one of the top shows on our network, and it's not, they've got good production values and they've got a great team, but the reality is it's exactly that. He just connects with the viewer on a very deep level. People are comfortable with him. They trust everything he says. He's not just schlepping product. He is actually, he's, you know, passionate about it. He's using it. He's developing product. So he's been very successful at doing that.
One of the things it is for me is he likes animals.
Yeah.
He likes animals. He likes knowing about them. He likes being around them. For him, animals are not a tool by which to secure fame
right. Or
perceived fortune or something that he kind of also a little bit doesn't maybe like that much.
Yeah.
It's like he loves wildlife.
Right.
And likes to be in proximity to it.
And all the elements of the hunt and
sure.
and the camaraderie and the family and all, yeah, it's
and likes talking to them.
Yep.
The speak the language thing is real. It's
right.
not just a cool slogan.
And tricking them, yeah.
Yeah.
If humanity were to end and all the planet were to die off except for just Will Primos, I think that Will Primos would still go out and observe wildlife.
Yeah.
I'm getting to this, you know, I shook the dude's hand one time and he didn't know who I was or what I was doing. It was a long time ago, but I'm just getting this from listening to his DVDs.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a good guy. and you know, an amazing businessman too. You know, I'm trying to think. He tells a story about how he got started making the mouth calls. He used to buy condoms for
to get the latex,
and I think he tells a story about being. I think he went and bought, had to buy some condoms, and he ran into like the father of one of his classmates, and was so anyway. That was before he was buying it commercially, and that. But there's so many little stories like that in this industry.
No, honest, just making game calls.
That's why I want to spend time in camp with these guys to hear more like that.
You brought up the idea. I'm not floating this, but you brought this idea up. Is hunting TV good or bad for the sport? I think there's a lot of people who hunt, a lot of people who fish. I feel that would say it's bad.
Mm-hmm. No, that's why I brought it up.
I hear it from them all the time.
That's why I wanted to talk about it, because I'm interested to hear what you all think about it. I generally think it's good, and we at the network work very hard to make sure that it's good in terms of the quality that makes it to air, the ethics around it, the storytelling, the conservation message, the, you know, recruitment and participation. I think those are all good things. But when I talk about the good and the bad and the ugly about TV, it's like, well, there's other sides of it that, you know, people don't care for. If you're a Western big game hunter, you don't like to see some of the things that, you know, your colleagues might do, and a big part of the market does. You know, there's people who don't like predator hunting, you know, or just, you know, it's just not for them, or Africa hunting. You know, that's a very polarizing, you know, part of our programmatic mix. In general, I think it's good, but I thought it'd be something worthy of discussing, because, you know, there are those who don't think it is, that this is a personal sport and that it doesn't belong on TV. I think it's done a lot to help promote hunting, and when it's done properly, it's a very good thing.
Yeah, if I was to think of the different criticisms I hear, I think that's kind of, that's a big one. It's just that Thomas McKinter, he didn't use it in this context, but like pissing in the cathedral, you know, that it's like this, it's this very personal thing. You're in the out of doors. You're out, you know, you're in the outdoors because you're, someone asked me why some people say out of doors and outdoors. When I grew up, there was a magazine, Michigan Out of Doors.
Mm-hmm.
I just got it in my head, out of doors. When you're in the outdoors, in nature, it's like this personal experience you're having. And some people feel that to film it and put it out there for distribution is kind of like sacrilegious.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like the whole point of it is that it's private and self-contained, and it's something that you live and experience in your own space and in your own head. And to take that and package it for consumption and put like a personality behind it, it strikes them as being a little bit offensive. And I think that of the other things, like, you know, the other criticism I'll have, people will come and be like, oh, it's, you know, it's all an infomercial, right? And I think you can kind of explain that by talking about what the model of it is, like how it works,
right,
how it's funded. But and I don't even really pay attention to that one. But the one that does strike me is that one where it's just like it's sacrilegious. And I think that the reason that speaks to me a little bit is because it is something that that I do, like, that part of me feels, right? Like there's like push and pull inside everyone's head.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even my own brothers who I grew up hunting and fishing with, and they're two of the most dedicated hunters and fishermen that I know, they just out of the box were deeply suspicious of my involvement in doing outdoor television.
Mm-hmm.
Writing about it, supportive of that.
Right.
They felt that aesthetically that's like okay. But then look at the deep history of it. Like, people have been writing about it since people were writing.
Right.
So there's a trajectory there. There's like a thing. It's like for 100 plus years more. Well, I mean, the it's kind of funny how deep it goes, because if you go back and look at the oldest known representational art in Europe, is people
wall art, right?
Writing the story of their hunt on a cave wall.
Right.
So it's something that it's like acceptable because there's something very personal and intimate about writing. But to them, it was kind of like, you're going to do what?
All right.
Like film it and then put out your innermost personal experiences out for like, why would they want to watch? You know, just a suspicion, man.
Yeah. It's tough.
And I've never really found like a really great way of countering. I haven't found like a great way of countering the argument. There's some things people say, and I always look forward to them saying it because you can tear their argument apart so easy that it's almost fun. But that one's not one I really look forward to taking now because I have to kind of say, like, if you feel that way, I'm probably not going to change your opinion about it. I'd like if you watch the show to see.
And your show could change that person's opinion, but there are others, and they're not wrong for it, that wouldn't, because it's more of a character-driven hunting show, and it is kind of a, hey, you know, look at me. Michael Waddell is a very passionate hunter in that, but he's a character. People watch him because they're curious about, you know, what he's going to say and how he acts, and that very different than Sportsman's Channel is. We've differentiated the networks a little bit, where Outdoor Channel is more general entertainment, talent driven type content, where Sportsman, because a lot of our magazines have driven that content, is more editorial style. It's less about the talent and more about the art, and so our viewers are different that way. And interestingly enough, I don't remember the exact number, but it's probably around like 40% of our magazine readers actually watch the network, the TV, because it's just a different type of consumer. If I'm going to read Guns and Ammo, it's because I'm interested in guns and ammo, and I want to go deep. If I'm going to watch The Gunfather on Outdoor Channel, it's because I want to be generally entertained. It's not because necessarily I'm a firearm enthusiast. So when someone says, you know, I think it's a very personal thing, they're right. For them it is, but for millions of others, it's not. It's aspirational. They're learning. It's very hard to generalize too. I mean, we have 200 different producers and a lot of different shows. So, you know, I could tell you that, yeah, your show is very personal for people, and whereas some of the others, you know, not so much. It's just about that hunt, and huge audiences like those shows too. So there's no right or wrong answer either.
No, the aspirational stuff is big because we get so many notes from people who watch the show, I'm sure a show, any show, and then say to themselves, I'm going to go do that.
Right.
Which is cool to hear about. And it's like, it's nice to know that there's that inspiring aspect of it.
Right.
And as in everything, there's also a flip side of that where you're like, man, so tags just got even a little bit harder to draw.
we'd get, and Montanans are unique. So wardens would generate a lot of feedback. And I remember, I've probably saved them. I should send you some of them. The locals in Montana did not like the Warden show because you're showing people where we hunt, you know, all of our great hunting.
Oh, really?
We don't like non-residents. Keep them out of here. You don't pay taxes in Montana. You shouldn't be hunting here. It's like, really? I mean, come on. But so we got some pretty good.
Begrudging tourist state, I've always said.
Yeah, it is. We've had interesting experiences there too, just trying to operate a show for 6 years in Montana. I mean, there was resistance.
Yeah.
From the general population, and there's also people who absolutely loved it, but not everybody.
Yeah, a lot of people hate any kind of incursion into their own thing. We try to be really respectful in any kind of public land situation,
right,
which is the bulk of our the bulk of our stuff is filmed on public land, and we have certain like lines we don't cross,
right,
in terms of not blowing a spot out. But that criticism is extended, even like that kind of thing is extended way outside of just hunting television or fishing television, because in the ski world, the surf world,
right,
I'm sure probably in the mountain biking thing, it's like there's people who feel passionate and do it. They look at representations of it, like public outputting. They're already suspicious of public output, people putting the experience out for public consumption.
Right.
And the first thing that's going to jump in their mind is, you're going to send the masses to my spot.
Right.
And when it comes to things like, a particular break to a surfer or a particular meadow, that's real, man.
Right.
It's like people are talking about like, oh, you're going to ruin, you know, tourism's going to ruin Paris, right? You're talking about like millions of people and you're adding some number more and it's hard to track it. But if you got like a little meadow that's easily identified, one dude ruins it.
So get this. So coming off of ICAST, my wife and I did some fishing. Two short stories from there. One, Mark Davis, who does Penn's Big Water Adventures, Big Saltwater, great show, great character.
Penn Reels.
Yeah, Penn Reels. So and Mark goes all over the world fishing, and he had somebody come up to him at the show, and they said, you know, you got to come down here. We got redfish. And Mark's like, And the guy was just selling him on the quality of the fishery and the giant fish and how amazing it was. And Mark's like, do you like your fishery? You like how it is? Then I'm not going to go there, because if he goes there, everybody else will go there. Not just show, but like people will show up, and it can have a significant impact on the fishery. And the example I'll give you is my wife and I fished with Carter Andrews after ICAST, and we found these red anchovies, these giant schools of red anchovies, really cool. I mean, like the size of a football field, and there was tarpon rolling in them. We did a Facebook Live event, and I caught a tarpon the next day in that, and apparently 2 or 3 days later, there's like 9 boats off this area.
Because people recognize the bridge or whatever.
Or they knew we were off of Vero Beach.
Okay.
And it's like, you know, so that was just some minor social media exposure. And all of a sudden it's like, I mean, I was gone already, but they had continued fishing, and they're like, yeah, when they showed up, there were already 3 boats on it. 2 other boats came in. The word is out.
But that's the funny, that's the kind of the point I'm making too, is the word is 3 people.
Right.
Like that's the tipping point,
right? And but then that spot is like done. I mean, there's too much pressure now, and it's like everything moves off. But on a more positive note, though, there's when you go to a tackle shop, and it's probably the same in Montana, where you go to a fly shop, but the word gets out, like, you know, whopper ploppers is a top water bait, and you can't find them around here because somebody started catching fish on whopper ploppers, and now all the stores are sold out. So you'll go in across the country, and like Rapala is headquartered here in Minneapolis, and they sell countdowns. These like just original floating Rapalas, and in one store they can't keep them in stock, and in another store they can't sell them because it's just some guy locally had success on it, and people just start hearing what, and the tackle guy starts, you know, there starts moving him. So as a community, we do a lot of word of mouth, I think. So you're right. It has a downside where you can really have an impact.
The criticism's so high there. Like if you do something, like if a person in outdoor media does something where you reveal that, people are pissed. But then if you go to any, you know, you go to any mountain town, right? And you go to the local fly shop, they put a sandwich board. What do you call those little things? Like,
right. I love that.
They put like a little board out on the sidewalk that says where the bite is.
Right. And what they're biting on. I think that's
Rock Creek, Squalus.
I think it's brilliant because, exactly. You know, if you're a retailer, you need people to have success, you know? So, and that's what, like,
But no one goes and kicks the door. Maybe they do. Do people get pissed at fly shops for sending everybody where the hot bite is?
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the same time, vague information too.
I think also
a creek.
Like, it's like, okay, yeah. I know this guy's telling me this. Probably just told the last 25 people that. Like we were over in the Henry's Fork this year, ran over there to fish. You know, the salmon flies were coming off on the Henry's Fork, and some of the guys I was with, they're like, "Oh, we got to go into the fly shop, and I got to pick up a few things." I said, "Okay, no matter what, this stretch that I want to fish is what we're going to fish, and that's
despite
it."
Your intel, yeah.
Like, I do not care what these guys think. So, of course, we end up fishing the stretch that the guys at the fly shop told us to fish, and I was just in a bad mood the whole time. We get down there. There's more trailers at the put-in than I've ever seen. The people running shuttles on the river have like 2 15 passenger vans out of shuttle drivers,
because
they're moving more boats and trailers on this stretch than they ever have. And I'm like, folks, this is what a sucker looks like.
That's unique to fly fishing, because bass fishermen lie. I mean, they'll come off the water and they'll say, yeah, what'd you catch your fish on? Oh, you know, we were fishing crankbaits and deep weed lines. And of course, they're fishing like worms on docks. They'll lie about everything, but the fly shops will. You know, I don't know if they embellish, but I appreciate it when they do that. But I can see how, yeah, you're gonna stack that river up in that section because they're telling everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was standing there with a buddy of mine one time years ago, and we had just skinned a bear. It was spring season. And we're coming out of logging road, and a guy pulls up, and he looks at my buddy's pants and says to him, "Looks like someone got one." And he looks him straight in the face and says, "Oh, it's just some old rabbit blood." You know? And it's like awkward because everyone knows that it's just not true.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like more, it was almost more painful to me than if he had just said, like, I'd have been irritated if he had said it, but it was more painful to me to have a standing lie. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I have a difficult time, like, if someone says, "Hey, how was the fishing?" I find myself trying to not lie, but then, you know, but, "Oh, it's okay. Got a couple." Right? Mm-hmm. I can't just be like, "Nothing," when in fact there was something.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you wind up trying to be like not a horrible person, but then also you want to serve your own purposes a little bit.
We're so fortunate in Minnesota. Like, bass fishing, if you like catching bass, I mean, the saying is, I think, God put bass on the earth so everyone could catch a fish,
mm-hmm.
and muskies to separate the men from the boys. So we're going to go musky fishing tonight. But if we want to, we catch bass. And you can catch bass on every lake. Yeah, exactly. On every single lake.
I grew up on a bass lake. Man.
Right. Well, every lake in Minnesota has bass in it. And they're not that smart. And they're fun. And so I'm all about participation, growing participation, taking kids out, taking friends out. I love to take them hunting and fishing. So I'm an open book when it comes to, and I'll also, like, if on my social media, I'll post when I don't have success, because otherwise people think, well, you know, they don't understand that we don't always go out and catch tons of fish. I've been able to fish by myself more this year. I've got three young boys, so it's normally I'm not ever by myself between friends, family, and work. But when I go on my own, I'll go and I'll explore new water or new techniques, and I won't have success. But, you know, we're going to fish a spot tonight that I found when I was looking for smallmouth beds. And gotcha. I ended up finding a giant muskie area. So
what do you call a musky area? Area?
This was just a weed bed. So the water was crystal clear, and I just kind of drifted over and I looked down, and it looked like a railroad tie laying on the bottom.
That's how you find them.
Yeah. And well, that's how I found that one, but you'll see a lot of them. And in the summer when the water's really hot, we don't generally target them when the water temps are way high.
So you don't want to hurt them.
Right. But they'll be kind of lethargic. They'll be up in shallow water, just kind of sunning. You can boat up to them and poke them with your rod, and they'll swim off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But they won't eat then. You know, they're not catchable. They're just not in that kind of pattern.
I was kind of, I went fishing with Matt Elliott from Benchman. You have too.
Yeah, Yanni served Matt Elliott his first ever bass sandwich.
Oh, nice.
Competition, a hobby, what do you call it? An amateur competition bass fisherman who had never eating a smallmouth sandwich.
He had a little
smallmouth
tear rolling down his cheek.
He thought it was good.
Oh, no. Yeah, he's just wiping that tartar sauce off his lips.
He thought it was good, and he didn't want his wife to realize that they were good.
But some of those...
Because she was wondering what he was doing that whole time.
Some of the rigs... You know, so I was super asking a bunch of questions, and I never get fish with that stuff, and going through...
Did you guys drop shot?
That is exactly what I was going at.
Oh, okay.
There are some rigs that these bass guys tie up that I just wouldn't fish with, purely for the fact, because I'd be like, well, of course you're going to catch fish with it. Like, of course.
Isn't that the goal?
But if there's a foregone conclusion, I'm just not that into it. The musky thing, super appealing. But the drop shot thing, I'm like, well.
When I started hearing, I do want to get back to what we're talking about, but years ago when I started hearing people say drop shotting, I was picturing, I don't know what I was picturing. I was picturing some, I just heard it and I thought it must be some elaborate, right? 18 knots and you know, crazy things running off here and there, whatever. And then when I saw that, I'm like, that's what drop shotting is? But my man, does that work good?
Oh my God. How can it not? I mean, I guess that's my, yeah. But yeah, I guess I would skew more towards the musky side of things because I want.
You want the challenge. The experience.
Yeah,
you want the experience. You want the 10,000 casts.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone. So it is, you have to enjoy the journey and everything else around it. Just like it's a difference between gun hunting and bow hunting. You know, the success rate's not that high, but you still do it because you're passionate about it. And it's not always about that kill. It's about the big picture and being outdoors.
Gets me more days in the woods.
So in outdoor TV, in hunting TV, are there lines that cannot be crossed? Surely if a producer turned into a thing where he was hunting panda bears, you guys would be like, you know what? Not going to be running that episode.
We have very strict guidelines, and we have a quality control team that enforces those, and producers are aware of those. If you're an independent producer, you don't want to spend thousands of dollars on something that's not going to make it to air. So it's pretty buttoned up, I would say. But yeah, we have lines. You know, we want to protect the sport, and so there's things and there's safety issues. You know, we don't want to show things that are unethical or unsafe. We don't allow blue sky shots.
So you enforce ethics?
Yes.
Like beyond law?
Yes. Our guidelines say you need to follow the laws, and then you also need to follow some of the, you know, general safety. It's not a, you know, obviously anything that's illegal is not allowed on game. You have to follow all game laws, and if there's violations, we are very strict in how we enforce those.
Talk about some of the things that have happened recently with hosts getting in hot water.
I can
think of three off the top of my head.
Yeah. Well, in the last three, yeah, I mean, our actions were pretty swift and pretty consistent.
Do you mind laying out the story of what happened? In just broad brushstrokes.
Like in the case of Chris Brackett for Fear No Evil.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, it's first of all, I told you that, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people that I work with and these producers, and Chris was one of them because Chris started with nothing. He was a postman, and he had a dream, and he had a passion, and I saw a video that Chris sent to Pat Reeve. And it was essentially a demo. It said, "Hey, Pat, I love what you do at Hunter Specialties. I want to get into this space." And, you know, so to see what happened was disappointing in a couple, you know, because the incident that happened in Indiana happened, it's like 5 years ago now, right? So where he shot two deer. And, you know, he put himself...
He had a tag for one, but shot two.
Had a tag for one, shot one. You know, and there's questions around that, too, because he had a camera guy with him. And people don't know the whole story. You know, they did tag the first deer that he shot. And, you know, so there's no...
don't know the details of the story. I'm not like being coy.
Yeah.
I really don't know the details of the story.
Well, the only thing people know is from what they saw in the video is that, you know, a deer came out and he shot the deer, and then another one came out and he shot that one. And,
okay.
You know, and he says he wasn't sure he shot this first one, and it's all speculation beyond that. So yes, you know, to take you through that. So when I saw the video and that, you know, I was disappointed. I mean, you know, disappointed on a human level. And I was, you know, Chris has evolved and had already evolved. He's a changed man from what he was 4 years ago. And people think that, you know, he went through this and then found God. No, Chris was actually had already transformed his faith life. But he's human. We're all human. So he made a mistake. And then another video comes up about him, you know, berating a camera guy. And it's like, I've been there before. No, I've never berated a camera guy like that. But, you know, Chris put a lot of pressure on himself back 4 years ago when he made that second shot to try to produce something, you know, and he made a mistake, and he's paid a pretty significant price for it. I mean, we find out about it, you know, there are some questions. So we had to do a little bit of research and, you know, and talk to Chris and talk to others about it, but we pulled the show immediately.
Is that a tough decision to make?
No, it's, you know, we have guidelines it was tough on a human level because I care for my producers. I care for Chris. I felt bad for him, and I don't want to, you know, don't want to pull the rug out. This is his career. This is what he's built up. But, and then, you know, ultimately, the show just, you know, he lost some sponsor support, and Chris is a guy. He's got a great heart. You know, I've had him at my home with my kids, and he's great with my kids and that. And he made a mistake, and it cost him. I think it cost more than it probably should have. But
if he was a private individual.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Private individual. This would have been. You know, first of all, he's never been charged with anything. So he just lost his career. He doesn't get a ticket. He hasn't. There's nothing has become of it, and nothing probably will, other than he's lost his livelihood as a TV host. And
it's interesting that the three cases that I'm thinking of, were hunting show personalities have been in trouble around these issues of shooting something, and then shooting something else. I think the thing you hear about that people fear is people are like, oh, being in that situation where you're this, you know, hunting celebrity, which is a term people hate, right? Mm-hmm. There's this hunting celebrity, and they're under such pressure to like get that big buck in order to become more famous, that they're put in these situations where they have poor judgment because they're trying to service business. Right. Which would sort of imply that violations and getting in trouble is sort of just like only happens in outdoor TV, which we all know that it certainly doesn't.
Right.
And there's a lot of guys that get in a lot of trouble all the time who are not putting it out. But it's a thing I think that people feel. Another thing that I think people feel from the other side is people like to make examples of people. You know? So when someone gets in trouble for something like that, you know, especially who's in the public eye, they get in trouble for something like that, it gets quickly amplified.
Sure.
Where people are very ready to pounce.
And in Chris's case, he has a polarizing brand. You loved him or you didn't. You know, he had his catch line, a booyah, when he would shoot a deer. You very passionate about it. You either loved it or you didn't. And for every viewer feedback I got, people saying they didn't like Chris Brackett, I got 10 that said they loved him. You know, so
because people found it offensive, that kind of like
they just didn't like, you know, they didn't connect with him. And so that, you know, you get the keyboard warriors, and you know they'll go off on him. So when that incident happened, it essentially made all of his detractors right. They came out, and I would tell you it was disappointing. I love this industry. I love the hunting industry, the fishing industry, and that. But we are fast to consume each other when something like that happens. And there were people that seemed to take pleasure out of taking him down, man. And that was heartbreaking.
I was looking at a thing the other day involving an acquaintance of mine where something no one knows, something may or may not have happened. I haven't even really looked into it yet, but I just heard, not a television person, just a person that maybe got sideways with the law a little bit. And man, there's a lot of people rooting that he did. Yeah. Hoping that he did.
Right.
Within the industry? Like
just people aware. Just like the cannibalization. And I think that, but I think in some of these cases where it'd be interesting, because there's this other case. Are you willing to talk about an instance that involves an individual whose initials are TV?
On our network?
Yeah.
I don't know who it is.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, sorry. I thought you were talking current, so.
No, that's an old one. But it's just an interesting case study.
Right.
And something that winds up...
Let's just talk in general terms, because I don't know what my limitations are in that situation.
So in general terms, it was a person made an accident. Okay.
Right.
A person had from having done a lot of hunting, a thing that I regard to be something that could happen to anyone.
Right.
Meaning, you, let's just say there's different situations where you see a deer, there's a buck standing there. and you shoot, but you go over, there's two bucks or two deer because there's one behind it that you were bedded down up a little rise that you were unaware of. That could happen to anyone.
Right.
Or a situation being that here's a buck, you shoot, the buck goes down, all of a sudden the buck stands back up again.
You shoot again, and
you think you're doing the right thing to shoot again, but you go over and it's two bucks. Now, in those cases, even if you are a hunting celebrity, I think in those cases where you to self-report,
right,
I feel that you probably wouldn't lose your show.
No.
You probably wouldn't get skewered. You might even get rewarded is really the wrong term, but people might recognize the step you took,
right,
and decide not to skewer you and try to destroy you.
We've had positive cases where that happened. You know, Pigman had an incident in Oklahoma. You know, first of all, game laws are complicated, right? And I think he was in an area, I don't remember the specifics, but you know, he ended up, I think, shooting a hen turkey or something, and he wasn't in a unit. He had he had everything. He thought he had everything right, and he didn't. He owned up to it. He paid a small fine. It was an honest mistake. Whereas, you know, in some of these cases you're talking about, the cover up is always worse than worse than the crime. And it's something I learned. You know, I've never had an encounter like that with a warden, but filming wardens for 6 or 7 years. You always got to, the only answer is to come clean fast and completely. And that's your, because these wardens are not out to get you. People make mistakes. They have a lot of latitude in what they can do. But if they know that you're being deceptive, you're done. There's no more sympathy. I mean, you will get whatever it is that you, and they'll, and 100% of the time they figure it out. So in some of these cases, you just have to own up to it because, no, absolutely, people make mistakes. But yes, if it's a case where you blatantly disregarded the law and wasted, you know, that's going to have deep and immediate ramifications.
Yeah,
negative
and
impact.
That's what really seems like lead people into a very troubled path is the cover up. And in that situation, you're making this kind of like quick decision. You're like, there's a chance if I just hide this, right, cover it up, there's a chance nothing happens. And man, is that seductive.
Right.
But there's also the chance that everything, that the world as I know it could end.
Right.
And by going the route of being like, Mr. Game Warden, I made a mistake.
Right.
There's going to be, there will be ramification. But total annihilation of oneself isn't probably in the mix.
No, we have Bowhunter TV. Kurt Wells was in Canada years ago, and I think a legal moose was like 50 inches, and he shot a moose, and it was like 49 3/4.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't, and it was a good shot. I think it was a bow shot. It was like 40 yards or something, and he self-reported and paid a fine. It's an honest mistake. It was, you know, he and the guide, they judged it to be a legal bull, and it wasn't. Same deal. You know, he could have hid that, but no, he, you know, did the right thing, self-reported, made that part of the story. He lost the trophy. I think it's
made it part of the story.
Yeah,
that's great.
It was the story. You know, we got to. That's got to be the story. The story has to be do the right thing. And we actually, in our guidelines, you know, you have to follow the law, but we want to hold our host to a higher standard because we are being watched by everybody, and so. You know, we always advise people don't you know the rules. You need to follow them. You need to have license. You need to wear blaze orange where it's blaze orange. Because right now law enforcement watches outdoor TV and they look for violations. We've had cases of that as well.
We had a warden tell us what state were we in where the guy said, "You know, I don't need to be out in the field anymore. I got Facebook."
Yeah,
Idaho maybe.
No, it was in Kentucky.
All right.
The warden said that.
Yeah, game warden. He just was, I'm sure partially joking.
No,
he's
but
like, I don't need to drive around anymore. I got Facebook.
I had a, Oregon state troopers or game wardens, and some are supposed to be more game wardens than state troopers, but I had a state trooper in Eastern Oregon basically say that
that's how he's made all of his recent busts were all through social media.
Well, and also just going to the local bar. I mean, in Montana, the wardens, the most successful wardens are, you know, have very good local networks. And so, because they, you know, they've got 400 square miles they're covering, they can't be everywhere, but they sure hear a lot because most guys who are poaching, you know, go to the bar and talk about it.
And they're competitive too.
Yeah.
And they have their own territories is what this guy was saying. And so a lot of the information that they'd get would be from other poachers being like, yeah, hey, I found this buck on the side of the road with its head cut off. You going to do something about it? Got a pretty good idea who it is.
Really?
Yeah.
It's like drug dealers shooting drug dealers.
Exactly.
I had another on that same trip. I think it was the same trip where the guy was saying, I don't need it. I have Facebook. Another thing that he said to me that I thought was interesting is he doesn't like suppressors.
Yeah.
And his argument against suppressors is the gunshot is a very important tool for him. And he was saying, as it gets when he's bow hunting and it starts getting close to rifle season, he can't finish a night in his tree stand because. And he's like, something about that shot.
Yeah.
And he's down out of his tree stand, zinging over in that, you know, getting in his truck and going over in that direction. And that was his, like, criticism of suppressors.
Yeah, I found it suppressed, and it's, I like it. You know, I follow the law, and so I'm not trying to.
Oh, yeah,
know.
They're great.
Yeah.
They're great. But I never looked at it from, I look at it from the perspective of just quiet.
Yeah.
But he looks at it from the perspective of he wants to know what's going on out in the woods, you know.
And you know, they you can still hear them, but yes, you can't hear it.
Yeah,
like a 30-06 or
it was a thing I had considered when weighing it, and like all these different states are sort of like weighing what the relationship will be to people being able to use suppressors. You know, I was in Scotland one time, and they were shocked. They were shocked you'd be allowed to not use a suppressor.
Yeah.
Because of what it does to people's ears.
Right.
I was like, man, you guys use suppressors? It's like, you guys don't? It's very different.
Yeah.
Free content, man. People go on YouTube, watch hunting videos all day long and never pay for anything. What's that spell? Like, what's that when you look into your crystal ball? What are the business challenges there, what does it mean for the consumer?
Yeah, I think there's room for all of it. I think it's a different product. You know, I consume on my mobile device. I consume short videos, whether they're, you know, Facebook or YouTube or what have you. But it's very different than the television that I consume, whether mm-hmm. it's hunting or not. So,
yeah, every producer you work with does short form content,
right? It depends. You know, we went through this evolution where everybody had to invest in high definition equipment, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of gear, because the idea was we're all going to have 90-inch, you know, flat screens. And now viewers don't seem to care that much. They'll watch crappy video from a cell phone on a cell phone, and it's adequate. So I think.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right.
So
what year was it when, do you remember the timeline of when?
Yeah, it was, can't remember where I was. It was 2008, 2007, so 10 years ago, you know, the evolution, people started moving towards HD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, networks weren't carrying channels in HD. Now everything is pretty much in HD. But the concept of free, I think free ultimately will hurt the industry. Because if it's not valuable, it will hurt on the high end of quality. Because if I'm Jim Shockey and people don't appreciate the quality that I'm delivering of my TV show because they can watch something for free on YouTube, then advertisers aren't going to support it, and then Jim's just not going to do it. So I think free content, free on the internet has a place, but it's also a very crowded marketplace. Our networks are a platform where we have viewers who are trained to turn on the hunting channel, they call it. They just turn it on and they watch hunting. Whereas if I go to YouTube, you know, first of all, you have to find the right, and you can narrow it down. You can search and do that, but you sift through a lot of garbage to find some of the gold.
It's dispersed,
right? And yeah. I think it'll be very hard. It would be very hard. I've got a son who's got a YouTube channel, right? He's got 19 followers. How do you, as a aspiring outdoor talent, build an audience? I mean, television is still by far the best way to reach a mass. I mean, look at Facebook. Recently, had their issue with privacy and the data issue they had. And I've heard at one point it was $1 million a day on linear television advertising to regain the trust of their user. They have this platform, but they go to linear television to reach that audience.
Yeah.
The Super Bowl last year, did you see who the presenting sponsor of the Super Bowl was?
No.
YouTube Red. So YouTube.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So they were the presenting sponsor of the Super Bowl.
So they see some value in linear television.
I think for any brand to say there's not value in linear television is I think that's a temporary position. We're already starting to see where digital, the good news is for an advertiser or a brand, there are more and good digital options to get a message out and connect with people. The bad news is it's still not as good as TV, and you need all of it. And yeah. the best brands have digital, they have print, they have radio, they have billboards, they have TV. You know, we don't always have the luxury in our space to have that whole breadth. But TV, by far, still delivers. The other thing, it delivers volume and quality and low risk. Because I might, if I have a product and I want to advertise, do a digital ad, I don't know where that ad's appearing. I don't know if it's appearing on appropriate sites or how my brand is being associated with that. Unless, if you're advertising on our digital platforms, where if you have a holster, it's appearing on Guns and Ammo's Facebook or website. So, I read an article. It was the national advertising market in all of television is driven by like 200 brands, like Coca-Cola and the Unilever brands and all that. So, and there's very little fraud. I mean, you buy advertising, you measure the results, you know how much you're paying, and it's good. And advertising works. We know advertising works. And in digital, there are tens of thousands of people, and the results are highly suspicious. So there's no magic yet. The allure of digital and free is strong because it's in theory cheaper. I just don't think it's as effective. And some of those big brands are going back to TV because it's more expensive, but it works and it still works.
I think that there's just room for a lot of different things. And I think even if you look within our own organization that I'm involved in, well, put it like this. I like to eat very well-prepared, elaborate meals sometimes. And I'll also sometimes eat a gas station hot dog,
mm-hmm.
particularly when I was in high school and college.
Right.
Right? I don't be like, man, now that gas station hot dogs have come out, I no longer want to eat an elaborate, well-prepared exactly. meal because it's just different. And so in doing... in making content, I look at an episode I look at a Meat Eater episode. It's 22 minutes where, this is not an exaggeration, every second was fought over.
Right.
Every second of it. Okay. And it requires a certain amount of money to do that.
Right.
That's like its own thing. I also like a funny cell phone video, right? But they're just very different. And I think right now I'm watching Ken Burns' Vietnam series. It takes a lot to put that together, right? It can't be that free, like as great as free YouTube content is, I would hate to live in a world where somehow we were starved of the polished stuff.
Right.
But I don't think we will become starved of the polished stuff. But I think people keep trying to like force this idea, or hoping there's this idea that it's just one version, the polished version, will be abandoned in short of the gorilla version, or the gorilla version will be abandoned in short of the polished version.
That's right. Like, so, there's room for all of it.
And looking ahead, there's a lot of apprehension, you know, about where it's coming from. When I started out in my career, I was writing for glossy magazines, you know,
which, by the way, have been dead for over 10 years,
right? They were dying when I started.
We have 17 magazines that are, that thrive. They're still doing quite well.
Yeah. They've been declaring that death, and a lot has changed there. I remember having a $10,000 travel budget to do a magazine story. Like, a lot of that stuff's changed. And so came out of magazines, and I went into traditional books. Okay. And, they're still a thriving book business, but then people declared that with Amazon, the traditional book, you know, the author publisher relationship is no more. That's all going to die. And I used to live with constant apprehension and fear about the future. But then at those times, they hadn't even come up with a podcast yet.
Right.
I didn't know what a podcast was until I went on one. I've just gotten to the point now, after a long time of making things, I've just gotten to the point now where I've kind of like worked through the fears, and now it's become more of a curiosity.
Right.
About, I do wonder how all this will sort out, but I do maintain this idea that there will continue to be, and I hope and push for it, there will continue to be ways to fund, ways to fund the really, like, not great in the way that, I don't mean great in the way that you're passing a value judgment on other stuff, but ways to fund very polished, relatively expensive pieces of content that just, that to my eye, really shine.
Right.
Well, look at TV or programming outside of, you know, our industry, right? It's like, we're all still, whether you're not, even if you're not paying for cable anymore, you're paying for Netflix to like watch
highly produced
good still, stuff,
yeah,
right?
Still like a paywall.
Like, I've yet to someone even tell me about like, oh yeah, go check out that new show on YouTube. Like, it just hasn't happened yet.
Right.
So
because there's like people.
It's hard to do it for free, right?
Well, one thing you see in all those cases, and you look at, you know, Auto Bytel was going to kill the car dealers, and all, the internet was going to kill print, and it definitely changed, and it's gone through painful process, but all of these businesses had to adapt. And so if you don't adapt to this new technology as a network, if we weren't adapting, we would lose some relevance. But we are adapting. You look at Comcast and Dish, DirecTV, they are independently, each one of them is investing over $1 billion in products and services and the customer experience to make TV better. I use my wife as an example. She's not a big fan of paying our cable bill, but we have Xfinity, and we have the Xfinity remote that she talks to now, and it's changed the way that she can now, you know, for her 400 channels was just too much. Now she can, through the remote, get what she wants when she wants it. Video on demand, I think, is becoming more more accessible, where you don't have to, you know, dive in and search. If I want to watch Meat Eater, I say Meat Eater, and if it's on demand, it's available. So television is evolving, and the technology is driving it. And as a network, we're committed to being on every device with all of our content wherever you want it. But and the whole cord cutting, and there's absolutely been a reduction. We're still at, I think, around 98 million paid cable and satellite homes in the U.S., which is about what it was 10 years ago. So it's off from its peak, but there's still 100 million people. And we all have family, extended family. You know, people in your family who still, like, my mom watches Jeopardy every day that she can, you know, and that's what she will always do. So there's people still consuming it. There's also a lot of people who've cut the cord, and then they start cobbling their own cord. So they do Netflix, and they do ESPN, and they want Fox News, and they want some others. And all of a sudden, instead of paying $150 a month, they're paying $120 or $100, and they're not and they're missing something out. So there's cord returners. There's people that are coming back. There's people moving to skinny bundles. Like we're on Sling and HD for Outdoor Sportsman and World Fishing Network. It's $34 a month. And their video on demand is fantastic. You know, you can watch multiple episodes, not just the current one, and you don't have to watch it at the appointed time. So it's evolving. And I agree. I think, you know, you still, that challenge we have as a network, and most people don't understand this because you don't really care, but the people making decisions about carrying hunting, shooting, and fishing programming, whether it's our network or not, are not into the sport, right? They don't generally care about hunting, shooting, or fishing. They're mostly lawyers and accountants that
are we live in a passion-based industry, but they're not.
They don't share it. They're in the numbers business. And so, you know, we have to fight to maintain our distribution, and we want to try to grow it because we have great content. We want to get it out there. But it's an uphill battle. If we had 90 million homes in Outdoor Channel instead of 35 million, we could be like History Channel and we could generate the ad dollars. I mean, cause just when you have that number, that sure number of homes, your ratings will go up. You can sell more advertising, you get more dollars in there, and then you can invest in that content. So it's kind of a catch-22 where we have 35 million subscribers for Outdoor Channel. And because of that, we don't have, we don't generate enough ad dollars to buy all the content. So that's how that time buy kind of came full circle back to that time buy model. Yeah.
Do you feel that hunters, like how far behind in the technology thing, how far behind are hunters generally? I mean, they got to be lagging a little bit, right? Behind like your average American in sort of adoption of new technologies and use of new technologies. Or do you feel that they just keep right in step? Because like they're almost by definition a little bit anachronistic, right?
Well, our audiences tend to be older anyhow. Like, you know, average age is probably in the late 40s to mid 50s.
Okay.
And so that's my age essentially. That, you know, we are users of technology, but we're not drivers of it. So our viewers are, we're not early adopters, but some of them are. You know, we have our My Outdoor TV package, which is just our the library of all of the old episodes. So, you know, that has skews to a much younger consumer, but it's also cheaper too. So it's part of someone's skinny bundle for like $10 a month.
Got you. Do you guys premiere people's new episodes on My Outdoor TV?
There's some that we do, but for now it's mostly, we do have some originals that we're starting to run on My Outdoor TV, but it's mostly library shows. And interestingly enough, and you think about your most passionate fans, and you're a bad example actually, because I think there's people that do a lot of binge watching on yours, but like for Lee and Tiffany, The Crush, it's a great hunting show, very popular, one of the best shows on the network.
Been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, and their fans don't watch, you know, they do 20 new episodes a year. Their fans don't watch every single episode. So, because that's just not the nature of TV. Like, if they only watch it when they're participating, so they're only watching September, October, they may only catch 3 or 4 episodes a year out of 20. So we have 150 episodes of The Crush in our library, and chances are even their best fans have only seen 10% of their library. So people say, well, yeah, it's old shows. Well, these shows are evergreen. I mean, it doesn't, you know, sometimes the technology changes a little bit. Maybe their sponsors change a little bit. But, you know, shooting a mule deer with a bow from the ground is the same today as it was 12 years ago. And, you know, so it's still evergreen content. And we're finding there's good demand for it. And there again, you know, people ask, why isn't it free? Well, because it's worth money, and these producers have paid to produce it. So we're licensing libraries from producers and offering it to consumers. So we're packaging it for them in My Outdoor TV. And, you know, just like everything, you know, everyone said everything's moving digital. Well, you know, you've learned, as you said, to kind of avoid the fear in that, you know, everything's not moving any one direction definitively, but everything is evolving, and we're evolving with it as well.
And it's just, for me, it's been to one, when you hear about the death of something, I now think, well, probably not. And then when new things come in, I just become interested in,
right,
you know, in the new things. And I'm less, like I said, man, I've been being told about I'm doing a magazine piece for Outside right now. And I sold my first story to Outside Magazine in 2000. And I was hearing about that, the end of that. I got a hardcover cookbook with Random House coming out. Spiegel and Grout, an imprint of Random House coming out this November. I've been hearing about how that's all calling it quits for my entire career.
Right. You know, in newspapers, and I know my former boss wrote for a newspaper for 40 years, and, you know, he likes the ink on his hands Sunday morning reading the paper. So that may be someday going away, but the newspapers, and they've all changed. I mean, they're you could argue that they were maybe too fat, magazines were too fat, and sort of things. You just have to adjust, but you can adjust and you can survive, and the content is still good. Yeah. I think the bottom line is, whether it's long form TV or short form or, you know, print, and that the content is what's valuable.
Yeah, it winds up being kind of like a gradual evolution of things, you know,
right.
New things coming up. But remember, like what we're doing right now, right?
Right.
This didn't exist.
Right.
This didn't, at a time, this didn't exist. And now it's a thing that just, you know, it's growing beyond early adopter phase, and it's becoming a thing that's like part of the American life.
Yeah. So I read an article about some YouTubers who were a guy, and I don't remember what his thing was to be like. He had 5.4 million subscribers to his channel. It wasn't in the outdoor space. It was something. And, you know, for years that base just grew and grew and grew. And now those guys are seeing declines. There seems to be, we think of internet as being limitless, but there's only 24 hours in a day. There's only so much time you can do anything, whether it's watch TV or surf the web or do what have you. So I think there's a natural max. And, you know, and it's possible in this hunting space, we've kind of, that's part of where, when you talk about all this content that's readily available, there's just too much that no one's going to win. You know, like it is at the risk of some of the higher quality content going away, because if I'm a brand and I'm just going to support people doing free content for product, and that high end's going to go away. But seems to be that it's not infinite. There's a natural cap, and like in like newspapers and that, I think maybe they push that limit. Well, now as technology's evolved, it's had to scale back. So that's probably where we're at in TV as well.
Yeah. Cal, what you thinking about?
Fishing.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff, yeah.
You fired up about giant muskies?
Oh, anytime on the water is a good time. Yeah.
But do you have any wrapper uppers, concluders?
Yeah, you know, just, I mean, thinking about all the stuff that was talked about here today, you know, I think you're exactly right. You know, there's plenty of content out there. Mitch, you are exactly right, that there's plenty of content out there that I do not associate with, and there's some that I do, and, you know, my hope is that all the content out there is at least connecting. The real benefit is like connecting folks that don't have the amount of access to the outdoor space that we all do, that they're connecting to it, and they're going to have some, hold that land and the outdoors in general in high enough regard to want to see it continue. That would be my best case scenario. But you know, I think there is
that media would inspire advocacy.
Yeah. Yeah, and at least get people to care enough to, you know, want to make sure it exists, even if they're not out playing around in it. You know, but you know, I think there's some content out there too that your example of, you know, it. I may not relate to it, but there's a lot of folks out there who do. Like, we get, for every negative email, we get 10 positive ones, and. I think there's some content out there that can be used to sway that 80% of the public that doesn't hunt towards, you know, a negative opinion on hunting.
Sure.
And there's content out there that can push that 80% in the positive way, right?
Right. So. For me, that's an argument for our networks and our guidelines because we are controlling that. Whereas on YouTube, you can put, I saw something on YouTube, a guy shot a doe with a 50 cal, like sniper rifle. And in fact, he missed the doe, but the doe's head exploded from the concussion of like just the, whatever, the bullet passing over its head. It's like that has,
and he thought that was pretty cool.
He thought that was worthy of posting. That wouldn't, you know, obviously never, you know, make air on our network. And none of us would advocate doing that, but you know, it's a free society, so that you'll have some of that on the YouTube, whereas we do control that. And
but I mean, even on OSG stuff, you know, there, I mean, I've seen you know, things again that I just don't associate with, and I'm a hunting, fishing dude, and if I don't associate with it, chances are the non-hunters probably are going to be like, probably even question if it's legal, if it's right. You know, so, you know, net, I, not knowing for sure, I just hope that at the end of the day, we're gaining and we're not losing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not much of a concluder, just a thought.
No, man, I'm digging there. That concluder, though. I like it. It's thought. It's provocative.
My hope in being on here was to help you understand that we are looking out for that, and we try, and we're not perfect, but we have I think a pretty good process and a pretty good team in place to try to make sure that we're doing that and keep getting better, because like I said, I think the net of the net is hunting television can really help us and can help expand the sport and help people and help make people better hunters, enjoy it more, you know, want to participate more in it when it's done right. And as a network, we take that responsibility very seriously.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, we premiered, I don't know, man, 90-some episodes of Meat Eater on Sportsman Channel.
Yeah.
Over a long period of time.
And I have to tell you, you talked about, you know, that crossing that line. Somebody watched your monkey brain episode where you ate the monkey brain. And
leg.
I thought, didn't you eat a brain?
No brain.
Someone did. Those boys did.
That's Indiana Jones.
No, I mean, there was...
No, you ate monkey.
Yeah.
Right. So I got a call from a producer, and that producer said, I just watched Steve Ranilli eat a monkey on Sportsman Channel, so I'm pretty sure I can do whatever I want to now, as long as somebody can...
But I would come in, and it winds up being a very different situation. Not different, but it's like, it's... you're in another country traveling with indigenous peoples who have lived there for thousands of years,
right,
carrying on a traditional life practice of theirs, and you witness them go and kill a monkey, which they do and would be doing in the absence of a camera, and you're present for that, and then they prepare the monkey and you're served some monkey and you eat the monkey with them. And it's like someone could come and say, he ate a monkey. Or you come and be like, well, let's look at the context.
Right. Oh, yeah.
In which it was done. But sure.
Right.
Sure, man. It wasn't lost on me that was risque is the word. It wasn't lost on me that it's like a potentially hot issue. But
if the context was frat boys being like, hey, I'll bet you a buck to eat that monkey leg.
Shooting monkeys out of a zoo. It's like... Right. It's just a very different.
Right.
It's just different. So yeah, if you go by the test, and this is a thing I hear from people all the time, where be like, well, what if someone just drops in? What are they going to see? I'm like, okay, you know, if you're the kind of person that just drops in and plucks seconds out of its broader context, you're more likely to find things that are upsetting to you.
Sure.
Than if you're the kind of person who comes in and takes those seconds and then sets them in their proper place.
Right. Which is why in our guidelines, we talk about if, you know, you can hunt lions, you know, it's legal, but we always recommend you need to tell the story. You need to tell the conservation story or elephants or things like, because it's controversial. And yes, if you take a sliver of that content, you can make it look really, really bad. When in the big picture, you know, we had Jana Waller from Skullbound on Sportsman's Channel was getting harassed about a show she did. She took some sort of antelope in Africa. Her whole episode was about the preservation of hyenas. If you watch that, I mean, yes, they hunted plains game, and she shot some sort of animal, like an impala, I think it was. But whoever complained about it, and they were anti-hunters, and that's probably my concluder that I want to talk about. They ignore all the good, and they just focus on that one little sliver. And I think one of my concluders is that we are. Our sport is controversial to many people, the Cecil the Lion incident, and that I think that moved a lot of people off of neutral, maybe towards the negative.
Sure.
And as sportsmen, we have a huge responsibility engage with PETA and convince them that what we're doing is right. But we do need to make sure that when someone does drop in, what they see on our networks is they might not participate in it, but they should think that, well, yeah, I understand that. And we're working on our conservation initiatives. A lot of it is, statistics show that if hunting for food is highly acceptable, like 71% of the general public accepts hunting for food, but hunting for trophies and using like trophy hunting, it's like 21%.
And it's a goofy semantics.
Right. So my concluder is, I've seen in those cases, and in the cases of, where the producers had issues, we tend to do a lot of infighting, and like the anti-hunters, they don't need to engage with us because in many cases we're our own worst enemy in those situations. And so as a network, we want to try to help be a positive force and bring people together and educate people about our passion and the good things about hunting It's not just the kill. And it's another thing I'll say in our guidelines. We don't say that you need to shoot big animals or you need to. In fact, we never say that. A 200-inch deer on camera doesn't rate any better than a 130-inch deer that like Stan Potts shoots.
Is that right?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't drive ratings. I think advertisers want that because they want their products to be associated
extra successful.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But then we're not focused on that. We want the more of the authentic experience in that. So, we just want, it'd be nice. Part of my goal and beyond here is to help people understand that we are actively trying to expand hunting and put our best foot forward and put the best content on TV that we can so that we've all got kids. We want them to be able to participate at the same level we are. And part of that is being able to get our message out.
And it comes with a certain amount of risk.
Yeah.
Yanni?
On that note, you have a pulse on like what's going on in the media and talking about the 80%. Do you guys have an idea of like how that 80% engages with the stuff that you're putting out there? Like where you sometimes reach them or how they find you or how you're trying to reach them?
In terms like reach them with?
Just however, like you're saying, like if that person drops in, right? And just somehow is randomly on Sportsman's Channel. How does that happen? Do you guys know what that looks like? Or do you guys know other channels or other avenues that somehow engages you and the 80%?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like tactics and how to draw viewers to our networks and that, we do our own advertising promotion.
You mentioned like Duck Dynasty, right? That brings...
Right. So we want to... It's very expensive, as you know, to launch a show and to market it properly. And in fact, the economies of scale in our industry is you can't spend $30 million on marketing a series. Like if you did a movie, they'll spend $30, $50, $100 million to market that. So that's why we look at a Duck Dynasty who has this established brand to come in. So yes, that was a big part of it. And it worked. And same with Deadliest Catch. We also do movies on Outdoor Channel and Friday nights, Saturday nights, people like to watch movies. So we do the movie, but if you watch a movie on Outdoor Channel, you'll see there's trivia. We use our hosts to actually have outdoor trivia. We're working on some other things. We want to bring in a new viewer and let them know that this is what we're about. We have other really cool content. So you may have found us via the movie or found us via Deadliest Catch, but look at everything else that's around.
Got it.
Good.
Yeah, that answered my question. But you did in your notes when we were emailing, you mentioned being an advocate for, you know, family hunting and whatnot. And earlier we talked about how we're thinking that, you know, it's debatable, right? But what hunter numbers are doing right now. Mm-hmm. What's going on with you guys that or what do you see, even if it's not you guys, but what do you see? What do you feel like is working the best to bring on new hunters?
Do you kind of want to ask why you're not seeing more squirrel hunting? Is that
the
small game versus the big?
No, that's not my question.
Oh, okay.
We do have squirrel hunting on hunts. Jackie Bushman has a squirrel hunting competition every year.
Nice. Oh, really?
Yeah. Airgun. It's an airgun competition.
Look into that.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, there's probably a lot of people doing a lot of different things to bring in more hunters to grow the sport, and you probably get to kind of see all of it. Is there something you can point out that you say, man, that seems to really be working?
Well, you know, we use all of our social media channels and all of our print and digital channels to put the best foot forward for hunting and bringing kids hunting and that. And our CEO, he advocates to producers to push more of that in your show. But by showing images and really airing hunts that help people understand how they can participate. I had an interesting conversation with a guy, and I won't say what state he's from because I don't want to blow his cover. But we were talking about hunting numbers and using licenses as a measure for participation. And what he explained was through contacts with wardens, they said in like major metropolitan areas, upwards of 50% of anglers don't buy a license. It's just, they just don't, right? So, but those anglers are buying bait and they're buying rods and reels and tackle and they're participating. They're just not buying a license. So because of that, they felt in this state, because he worked with the DNR, and it wasn't Montana, it wasn't Michigan, just so you know, but they felt that.
You have narrowed down to 48 now.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to get him in trouble. So the numbers of anglers is underreported. Hunting, on the other side of the coin, there are like 27 states that are one buck only, but you can party hunt. So guys are buying tags for their wives, their daughter, or their mother, so they can have extra buck tags in their camp, essentially. But those women aren't participating necessarily. So, you know, obviously, some of them are, but so they're not buying bows. They're not. These guys were doing research on why more people aren't buying crossbows and compound bows is what they were researching.
Yeah.
And that was part of it. It was the women are not actually. And so we say, well, look at the number of women who are buying licenses. Well, not 100. I'm not saying that it's like 90% aren't participating. I know there are more women participating in hunting than previously, but they think it's overstated because of that. And the states don't want to do anything about it because they might lose upwards of $500,000 in license sales if they change the rules, and then they lose federal matching funds.
Yeah.
So they're kind allow it. So it's tough to say, oh, you know, there's only 10 million hunters. Well, maybe there is, or maybe there's not, or, you know, it's not as acceptable now. And like with social media and some of the other just communication tools that are available, that you know, the Cecil the Lion thing couldn't have happened 15 years ago because that campaign would not have been able to be sustained by the anti-hunters for 30 days.
Yeah, the distribution channel wasn't there.
Wasn't there, right. Yeah. So it's
And you couldn't have popularized the image.
Right.
I mean, we've always had images that have come and really captured the American imagination and were widely distributed and very impactful, but it just happens in lightning speed and it happens more often.
Right.
Now. Yeah. Got anything else you want to add, Giannis?
No, that does it for me.
You liking them golf shirts, man, when you're traveling?
This is my only one.
Makes you feel like you're cool and comfortable but still professional.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your feeling?
Yeah. Exactly.
Hey, Ken, did you get attacked by a bear or something? He's got claw marks on his leg.
It does look like that, doesn't it? And when it happened, I was thinking that. Look at that. Got scratched up by a bear. But I was running through the forest. It's this new, if you're not extreme enough, there's this new thing I came up with called game trail running. So if just trail running is not cool enough, you can do game trail running. Or more extreme than that is no trail running. So when the game trail disappears,
just keep running.
Just off through the woods. At this moment, I actually wasn't running. I was probably just like hiking uphill, heaving, trying to get my breath back. And yeah, I stepped on a log that had no more log left in it and just gave out and scratched up my leg.
Would have been cooler if you said, yeah, I got attacked by a bear.
While running. I have one golf shirt that I just wore the other day for my 10th wedding anniversary. And I've had that one golf shirt for forever. And it's like if something special happens during the warm months, I wear that golf shirt. And it's got a lot of holes in it now. That's kind of why I'm curious about your golf shirt.
Moth got you? Or just
time.
It's funny.
Time. Time destroys all.
I brought you guys golf shirts as a gift.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm not even lying.
When I hit my 20th anniversary, I'm putting that bad boy on.
Are these known as golf shirts? I always called them polo shirts because I think like everybody when we were kids.
When I see a shirt like, to be frank, when I see a shirt like that, I think that person likes to golf.
Polo shirt.
That's what a polo shirt is?
Well, because it used to. Short sleeve shirt.
It's a polo shirt if it's got long sleeves. Don't they wear long sleeves?
Nah, it's a rugby shirt.
You're right. That's a polo shirt?
That's a polo.
But a polo shirt because it's like Kleenex is a tissue.
Right. It was this Ralph Lauren.
Polo shirt because Ralph Lauren had the little polo
by Ralph Lauren
on it. Yeah.
That little guy on
Not because they actually wore them.
Well, I'll sort it out later.
Do my own research, thank you.
I'll sort this one out after the show.
He does have a trout on there, and it's clearly Patagonia, so I don't think that's a golf shirt.
I am going to go have an Arnold Palmer here after this podcast is over to quench my thirst.
All right, well, Mitch Petrie, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.